Welcome again to Mystic Babylon. Today we have a mixed bag of poets. We have again some poetry from Berkeley and also some new poetry from San Francisco. We have some poetry from an open mic near the Boom Boom Room where John Lee Hooker used to play at 1661 Fillmore. And we have more poetry from the Cafe Mediterranean in Berkeley, like the last reading. As usual, I will read first, followed by the other poets. The poetry segment will start shortly. Hello, my name is John Rhodes, poet and creator of Mystic Babylon Poetry Podcast. This is my third recording. I have since the last recording upgraded my sound equipment, so my sound should be improving over the next few weeks. Let me remind you that all my poetry here is in a book called Spirits of Bondage and Inherent Transcendence, which is purchasable almost anywhere on the net. And I have a personal website at www.rhodespoetry.com. The Rhodes part of the URL is spelled just like it is in Rhodes Scholar. I will shortly start reading. This first poem is called Collective Spirit of Sacrifice. This poem goes over the struggle to actually respect and pray for life in the food chain that is so giving. One must be in touch with one's primal self and not just be an uncompassionate animal who doesn't see the great gift that lives of the lower part of the food chain give to us. This poem describes the main character satirically, who is the stereotypical man who eats TV dinners. Here is the poem. We have to preserve our collective spirit that respects nature, unlike the way the stereotypical city jungle spiritually deformed human does. He is the one who eats the mother of all victims, his woolly mammoth TV dinner frozen over as if it had been frozen over just for him from the Ice Age, so he can be free to eat it like an urban caveman. All pray, no prayers, no guilt. He turns and beats his chest so nobody can see, and woe is the man who thanks the butcher or tips him in spirit with the sacrifice, or in spirit touches upon it like the human sacrifice of Jesus is broached upon in church while on bended knee. The slaughter of the primal lamb is not accompanied by the magi, but is chopped and bagged without human trauma and is seen as a war like Vietnam. It is old hat to admit to the guilt of the quarry, but to admit that you have claws like the cat is another story. Nor do you quilt the murder of Mother Nature in your blanket heirloom as one of your relatives that you killed like a creature and consequentially brought upon yourself heresy and doom. You have a tiger on your coat of arms, but when you hide your animal heart and spirit under your skin as you wear the hide of your kin, you think that sin is synthetic and purely of human fabrication. It is such a sham that men who are wild and collectively untamed think that women, like the deer, are fair game. These men, far from being lion-hearted, cause the ladies to lose all concept of their timid domestic fame when they are forced to accept the hypocrisy of a covetous, conquered stock spirit of no shame under the guise of a family name. Tame man, not just animal, for rational primary support is not dangerous and should be mutual to Mother Earth and also to us. The second poem is called Tsunami. This poem is a poem that was inspired by a well-known Zen koan about a Zen neophyte named Onami, which I think means in Japanese wave. He asked the big question of his master, how could he attain power? And the Zen master told him to be like a big wave or tsunami. Mankind should create waves of compassion and integrity that can protect us from the ways of ignorance that engulf mankind and drown people in real tsunamis, because we fail to protect these people from these waves that are truly waves of stupidity. Here is the poem. Why do adults say they know what is going to happen when their adulterated view causes huge mishaps like Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan? Pinocchio trusts, even though disaster strikes in a blur, even when the superpowers of the older generation show fault, the children nap as this belligerence occurs. Why are there no myths for the blameless children? Are the artless melodramas of the forefathers that control them by default closing the doors to the mind's eye of the halls of truth, leaving open wicked houses built by ignorance? Old age is overripe fruits of wrath, where the aged stumble over the new generation that stands in their way on their narrow path. This shows that our leaders and God himself have not done their math. Saul had the gall to beguile and lead Christians to their fall while he looked in the mirror, seeing himself after he had persecuted his fellow Christians as very tall. Religion should have been written by the young, from whom hope has always sprung. Don't the grown-ups spit out all their trust of mankind and the hope of freedom as they put their favor in the youth's suppression? Aren't they the ones who said first, we don't need them? Thank you. This last poem is The Pirate at Dawn. This poem substitutes the idea of the devil possessing oneself with the idea of a pirate stealing one's soul. It gives social meaning to losing one's soul. Here is the poem. I idolize being free from the pageant of the possessed, whose unquenchable desires I don't criticize openly, but I still detest. They also desire freedom from total responsibility, but I covet my self-conscious sensibility that I use to discern a private, stable place in the world for myself, like a tract of open beach and sand where I can consider myself spiritually secure and in good hands where I can maintain fair health. I am proud of not being overzealous, nor am I supercilious and unbecomingly possessive of this singular treasure, and am happy to share it at leisure. What I attribute my success to was that I caught this selfish pirate who wanted to own my soul while he ate my fish as I suffered locked up down in his hold. Here I now contemplate life and its meaning as I advertise about this click to others on this beachhead of responsibility that I obtained when the pirates who were ruining my dreams confessed as they left this land to look for other islands from their crow's nest. They wanted no part of my mindful but diffident plan of enterprise for spiritual feasibility and success. I accept my own solidarity as a testament to my freedom from their mess. With just a few dollars of spiritual expense, I could afford a spot on this core cove of common sense. I paid the price, you say, but the price I paid was the effort it cost me to learn accountability and to be nice, for it was you too, my brother, who like me was by the escape from responsibility also enticed. Now I look with my spyglass on all the pirates of others' personal fortunes that have been made and spawned, that are stolen away from the unsuspecting, just as sure as every morning comes the dawn. Thank you very much.
I am the next poet, David Golub. I majored in English at Harvard, where I received a BA in 1972, and Stanford, where I received a PhD in 1978. In 1973, at a poetry workshop in Palo Alto, I met David Lerner, who got me my first poetry publications. I started going to poetry readings in San Francisco on April 7, 1983. This was the birthday of Billie Holiday, whom I decided was my muse. In the late 1980s, the Cafe Babar readings started in the Outer Mission. It was there I reconnected with Lerner and met other unforgettable characters. I hosted Babar for a time and put out the poetry zine Bullhorn. I lived with Lerner and Maura O'Connor in Oakland in 1993 and 1994, the year my father died. I self-published some chapbooks and from 1990 to 1996 had three chapbooks on Zeitgeist Press. They are available at www.zeitgeist-press.com. I lived in San Francisco and was in a band for a time. I now live in Berkeley and am looking for a new career and a new publisher. This is the title poem of my 1990s Zeitgeist book, As For Us. All I can say is it's about me and some of my friends. As for us, as night falls like a blade, we are seated on benches again, goggling at each other. Lenses bend our eyes, crutches of light. Hair streams out of our heads like smoke of thoughts from brains on fire. Our faces get stretched to caricature, each in the other's mirror, finding each other sweating on the spot, forced to dot dark exclamations even before we speak. Rage stretches the rein we keep on our voices taut, near to breaking, as if our very words were horses lacerated toward a stampede into chaos, desperate to shed their meanings, pulling the thunder of those empty wagons over badlands with ever more panicked resentment. Whose symptom is it, that unrelenting spur? Look at this world. People starve and receive from those with food in houses and hands in pockets, warm smiles, cruelty, not even for pleasure. Pleasure is punished. Look at us, drunk, furious, with a strong back suddenly broken, with a twisted leg, with muscles rotting on green bones, drug sick, rule sick, work sick, 86th, homeless, hungry, horny, choked in bed by the intolerable burden of another body's muscular love, choked on the dust of the blossoming acacia, longing for love and frightened of it, wheezing, sad, pissed off, broke, delivering ourselves the last wound with knife, spike, prick, sharp sorrow, just to be on the side of the sharp sorrow that seems always to win. Look at us, each with the identification badge of a conspicuous, personally tailored mortal wound held closed by enchantment. This is from my 1996 Zeitgeist book, As Needed for Rage. I wrote it when my father died. His cadaver, In Memoriam, Myron Golub, 1918-1994. We didn't get to hold a funeral for my father because he left his body to the medical school. I must imagine how some sensitive anatomy student will react. Intelligent anyway, it's one of the top schools in the country. When she or he peels open this wattled, shrunken, elderly male cadaver to find the malignant cells that have blocked an entire lung, the liver, that heavy, resilient organ, completely failed in his case, wide patches of brain tissue, either outright decomposed or shriveled in ammonia, the spinal cord pinched and pinched and pinched at the neck, withered muscles of arm, leg, a whole side, not to mention the battered condition of the heart. I rather hope whoever dissects him doesn't remove the customary opaque plastic bag from over his head to observe the long wisps of wavy hair, still black in places, the hawk-beaked intense expression, twisted with pain and helpless anger, the profound eyes frozen dark. We're Jewish. If there'd been a funeral, we'd have pegged the body shut in a plain pine coffin. As it is, I have to imagine some first-year medical student viewing it at length, and perhaps deducing his agonies, and perhaps even some of ours, without knowing who we are, only that we held no funeral, at any rate, none over a body, because my father wanted to go on being useful to his community, his school, and learning for as long as he could. This is a more recent poem. I don't know where it came from. Sometimes those are the best. The same song. The dead sing together, asleep in cells along a winding stair. No eye has climbed all the way to the Gestat panorama. The dead sing in blind pockets in the gut of a snake, reared up, slow coil upon coil, to slash fangs at the top of the sky. They sleep separate but sing together. Going on after you know you're dead is the only immortality. I could distinguish every voice like pearls on a rope with my eyes shut in the dark of our room. It was the same song we sing in our own sleep, we too, dreaming for a while that we're alive. This was a poem I wrote when David Lerner died of an overdose in 1997. I wrote it partly to save myself the labor of explaining over and over again what it was like to live with him. Absence of a large Lerner. In memory of David Zelig Lerner, 1951-1997. When he sat at the kitchen table in our living room, his plates, bowls, mugs, tumblers, 2-liter bottles, cigarettes, letters, magazines, and ashtrays splayed out across the whole formica surface like the deployed men of a manic, invincible chess master. He fed himself steak when he could afford or steal it, baked potatoes, fries, burgers, chicken, pasta in Corning dishes, pizza on greasy cardboard, poached eggs, cereal, Russian rye with lots of butter, or just chips and dips. Then a sink load of dishes. Then he'd pat around naked, huge, roaring about Jesus, Rambo, Bukowski, the death penalty, or Whoopi, expanding to fill almost all that little space, while Maura tiptoed around the edges with her cigarettes and smile, and I listened, envious and delighted, until exhaustion pushed me out to hole up in my little bedroom. The front passenger seat of my car pushed all the way back with the seat back tilted so he could recline and ease the strain off his back. David's friends got to calling car seat in the learner position, so that his very absence bulked large with us. My car seat already doesn't remember him. His absence is too big for it now. He expanded to fill all time, too. 30 minutes of just a second to put on his pants leg, and couldn't we put the Earth's rotation on hold? He could make a trip to the Safeway, a 2-hour action epic, with exciting adventures among the strangest of strangers, executive decisions over cantaloupes, bags of bagels, tubs of sour cream, and the squeeze past the narrow gates of financial judgment at the checkout. Getting him to write a check, he promised, took from breakfast till July sunset, while he was dropping hundreds a day on his habit. Over and back across the Bay Bridge, my Mitsubishi hatchback tailed the big black old Cadillac he'd bought. I was never more pissed off till now. The cab broke down later and he abandoned it. I guess he'd just been hungry for a car like that. In detoxed intervals, he would talk about his theory of addiction as a spiritual hunger, and his voice would get quiet and intense, like his best reading voice, when a crowded room would shut up, and you could almost hear them strain to drink his meaning. He ate up the silence of those ears he fed, as he ate up Bach, Coltrane, Rivera, the Holy Ghost, and words, 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 written words, quoted words, or words of his friends. Whence, when I was hustling him down a hospital corridor in a wheelchair and his leg dripped blood over the fresh mopped white linoleum, an orderly challenged me. "What have you got there?" I shouted, "Bleeding man!" David smiled. Agonized and bleeding as he was, he relished that. Agonized as he was, I thought he'd swallow the universe like a poached egg at breakfast. I could just hear him grumble mildly, "If it wasn't cooked." This is another recent poem, I'm not sure where it came from. And I hold that light. Some days I wake up and I've been walking down a blackout blind corridor, I don't remember how long. I grope around in my pocket until I find a certain day of the past like a gold coin. When I clutch it, it shines in my hand. My fingers see it by faith on a good day, and I hold that light. A few days have hammered my eyes open to stare at the world. My face, stamped fire new on the face of the sun, shines until it sets in my pocket. Other days are more than days. I don't remember when I slept last. My fingers lack pocket sight. My feet keep the faith, walking entirely blunt. Thank you very much, and I hope you'll buy my...
Hello, I'm The Last Poet, and my name is Dr. Concrescence. John found me at the Unity Cafe Poetry Reading, which is the first Monday and third Monday of the month on Fillmore, put on by E.K. Keith. I am a poet, I'm a hopo priest, and I'm a father. If you want to know more about me and some of my philosophies, you can find me at www.earthrights.org. Look under the Earth Rights magazine and Dr. Concrescence. The first poem is called Love of the Fall. My mistakes define me. That job, that breakup, that loss. Bliss is hard to hold. That love, that joy, that moment. Except in contrast, that now, that then, that this. This is The King. As if it matters how many times I push this boulder or pull this sword, or if I wash the whites with the colors, or even chew, mouth open, crumbs flying, making a point about transpersonal meaning and the global implications of our digital prophecy on intelligence and our local paradigm. You know, the parking structure on 20th that no one will finish. All you care about is that from the random flotsam that escapes from my thorax, gullet, maw, that some of it makes sense out of time and out of place. Not that tonight the garbage must be on the curb, color-coded to prevent seals and otters from sneaking up to the geese and ducks, garroting them with industrial waste and then framing our local rural peasant who owns a gun and knows how to endanger when drunk with a raucous caw or belch or blurp. But that I know who you will love, when you will love, and what love means to you, that you are blessed and growing, and stasis will end like the inevitable seasons. You care the oldest care, a king or a queen, name the seasons, and from those seasons we can, with due diligence and intelligence, face fate honestly and in full measure. But yet, although you see the king in me, still you want me to balance my checkbook and make plants grow. Do you wonder why I hide in this mess and only come when you call? Understand. Fire under earth, a darkening of the light, literally wounding of the bright. Fear and trembling at infinite choice becomes a path, pruned or injured by bramble and vain thorns, undone and alone. Recognize a figure standing in the liminal dark, confronted by a once road home, now obscured and buried by choices made, thickened by twilight around ancient oak, who once may have been a god, but now is simply a hollow infrastructure for ivy and insects, with the occasional bird taking flight, their sudden migration reconfiguring memories of movement and missed moments, with my daughter, who I am sure will sit beneath her own banyan tree, like the Buddha or Arthur under his oak, and have her own moment of pure joy and understanding, washing away this forgetting of what should have been were it not for the wilds of time, and she will see me standing, gesturing. This way, sweetheart, past this oak and under the bramble, stand with me here at the home of what could have been and is. And this is my last poem. Charming. It was here I remembered you, explaining that you were perfect, but the translation was not. I spoke flawless Latvian till the age of 8, when objecting to my boredom, I taught myself to read amid child-centered grimoires, English casting its spell. Bound here, I have forgotten how to flirt. Maybe I never knew, or what I see beyond understanding. I would live my life in translation, bad habits, a divorce, embarrassment therapy, signs and sigils of the future become blurred by forgotten grammar and syntax. Green eyes, a face and a body that annihilate my meaning, baffle my intention. My mother's voice hypnotizing me into sleeping submission, lost in Sanskrit groves, seeking something, anything which would satisfy the playful, unafraid heart's beat spiral toward another possible thing, but I do not remember how to say it. Thank you.